C-158. Summary of the first four chapters in Science and Health. The structure of the Christian Science textbook, Our Way of Life. Number 1A.
We come together to review the work we have been doing during the last 2 years together. And having done an earnest work and having worked consistently, I think it is right to have the seventh day, the day of rest and of peace, where one lays down the work and just sits back to reconsider what has been done and accomplished. So what I would propose to do this weekend is just to sit back quietly and calmly and peacefully and to review gently the big lines of what we have been doing, so as to mother this idea and not only always to express the fatherhood sense to this idea, the fatherhood sense that always wants to go forward and forward and forward to see new light and new vision. But that must also be coupled with a sense of motherhood that takes in that vision and worships it and adores it and is happy and joyous over the child. So that's what I try to convey during this weekend. It is the Sabbath day, which also would introduce the sabbatical year, which we are going to have. Perhaps it will be 2 years of Sabbath. I don't know yet. We will leave that to the unfoldment. But it will be a time of great activity in rest. On that seventh day, God rested in action. It isn't a sitting back and doing nothing and thinking nothing, but it is a period of which I want to speak tomorrow more in more detail, a period to reconsider what has come to us during the last 2 years. Now, so often here and at home, students say to me, "Oh, I would like to give a lot of time and devotion and energy to this idea, but even if I take the time, I don't know really how to get at the subject." And so I want to spend a few minutes just on this method of how we can tackle a chapter in the textbook or a book in the Bible, whatever the subject is the same if it is about the Bible or the textbook. But there are certain rules that seems to be fundamental in tackling a new subject. And I always remember John Dolly telling us that we should be in this work of discovery like a sculptor. A sculptor who has at his disposition a block of marble or granite. He has perhaps in view what he wants to chisel, what he wants to produce. But the very first thing he does is to get first the big lines, the big proportion of what he is going to chisel out. And then always from there he goes to smaller proportions, to smaller details, until finally that which is in mind crystallizes and comes out. So he goes first to the big line, to the big proportions, then always to some smaller proportion until every detail is proportionately right. And this is the right method of tackling such a proposition. The sculptor could choose a wrong method. And in that wrong method, he would proceed like this. He has perhaps in mind that he would chisel out the stature, and he's perhaps very fond of forming a hand, and so he would chisel out first a hand, and then perhaps an ear, and then perhaps a toe, and then perhaps the nose. And as he goes on with every detail, and then when he finishes all the details, he sees that every detail is out of proportion, not at its right place. And so, that is, you see, the details may be nice, may be beautiful, but because they are not in the right proportion, they are not right, and so they are not beautiful, and they are not good. And the same is true when we have a chapter of the textbook in front of us where we yearn to see clearer and clearer the meaning of this chapter, or the meaning of the whole textbook, or the meaning of a book in the Bible, whatever it is. If we start by just pondering single sentences, single remarks in that chapter, then we won't get the beauty and the depth of that chapter. It's like starting, like that sculpture, starting with chiseling out a hand or a finger, and then afterwards an ear, then afterwards a toe, and so on. It has not its right proportion, doesn't get its right proportion. And so when we just fall in love with some statements and some remarks in a chapter, we will give to these remarks much more weight than they really would have and should have within the whole concept of that chapter. And we lose the depth of the chapter. So the best thing always is that one takes a subject, let's say we take a chapter in the textbook, that one first goes over the whole ground in a big way. That is, that one reads that chapter first through and through again and through again consecutively, perhaps even quick, not very slowly, just to get an overall view of the chapter. It's interesting that Goodspeed, in his book on the Bible, he also says, read a book on the Bible through quickly as you can, and read it through as many times as you can quickly until you get the touch. And that's what we have to do too with the chapter, to read it through, and to read it through devotedly, earnestly. And when we read it through, perhaps after 3 times, perhaps after 5 times, perhaps after 7 times, somehow something begins to click in one's mind on that chapter. It is as if something begins to become identical within oneself, which is in the chapter. And the correspondence in some way begins to speak within oneself. And if one takes that opportunity where spiritual sense perhaps in a slight way, in a meek way, begins to speak in oneself, if one takes that opportunity and begins to adore it and to nourish it and to love it, it grows. It begins to grow in oneself. And little by little, one begins to feel that there is some line, some message in a chapter. Just perhaps slightly, one begins to feel it. May not even yet correct, not even yet to the point, but the outlines of it, the spiritual outline of it, begins to speak to oneself. And so, little by little, the chapter yields its treasure to us. And in yielding this treasure, one always can ask oneself questions. And questions like this, that one asks oneself, well, what is really the beginning, the starting point of a chapter? What is really the end point of a chapter? And how does she bring the beginning to the end? See, one begins to ask question, well, what is the proposition at the beginning of a chapter? What is the climax of the chapter at the end? And how does she, through what steps, through what reasonings, through what spiritual steps, does she lead the primal proposition to a climax? See, asking questions is always a good thing, because it's the activity of the mind that is mobilized, and that's a good thing. And the moment one asks a question, an answer must be given, because one only can ask a question on something which has an answer. So that's one main point which I like to give you on the way, that it is always a good thing to read a chapter through and through until it begins to speak to us. Then, in doing that, one has to be careful not to be sidetracked, really, by details. If we want to find really the depth of a chapter, the bigness of a chapter, well, we must be careful not to be sidetracked by details. And we can help that by trying to listen not to single words, what single words mean, what a single sentence alone means, and think in one sentence is especially the climax, but by listening spiritually to the great line of reasoning. See, to leave the letter as much as possible out of that attitude, and to say to oneself, I want to hear the story, the spiritual story of it. And so, one, at the beginning, I say at the beginning, it's a good thing to leave out the study and the investigation of single terms, or to be sidetracked in its meaning or in its story by the use of a synonymous term in the text. We mustn't think that if she uses in a paragraph mind, that she speaks about mind in that paragraph. That's not so, you see. So we don't need to be sidetracked by terms, because in every paragraph we may have 20, 30 numerals, ideas of the seven synonymous terms. We may have one or two or more synonymous terms in it. But all that is no indication of the subject, of the story. See, that's why so often a student says, well, I just can't really see the story in a chapter, because here in this paragraph she uses mind, and in the next paragraph she uses truth, and in the third paragraph she may use soul. There is no order in it. Oh yes, there is order in the story. But the synonymous terms, the few synonymous terms she uses on every page are no indication, no reliable indication of the story she is speaking about. The story, the spiritual story, is kept, is closed with terms, with words. But the tone, the story, is spiritual. And so we have to see that we catch that story. That story. Now, in prayerfully reading a text, and one has to have a prayerful, devoted attitude when one opens the Bible or the textbook. We just can't do it with our brain. It's a prayerful attitude with which we have always to approach a text, a prayerful attitude which is just full of expectation, full of adoration for a revealed text, full of adoration that God has once spoken through a revelator, and that he can speak to us again just in the same way, helped perhaps through the text, but that we are really on Mount Horeb, where God is revealing itself. If that attitude is there, then I think in that prayerful attitude, if we read the text, slowly the story begins to yield and to become clear into our consciousness. It's mostly only a question of perseverance and a question of devotion and love. It's not, as so many students think and have tried, and I think we all belong to them, that through arduous study, through hours and arduous study, we can do it. It's through a perseverance of a spiritual, prayerful attitude in considering the text that does it, that opens up the treasures. When we approach a subject like this, and when we open our mind to the story that is being told, and not to the terms and to the words, that is, not to the letter but to the spirit, if we open our mind prayerfully to the spirit of the story and devotedly reach out in our heart for revelation, then we may see very soon that some subjects within the chapter begin to unfold. That suddenly we begin to feel that over paragraphs and paragraphs she's speaking around the same subject, around the same tone, around the same subject, I would say. And then that suddenly from one paragraph to the other she changes the subject. But that change can usually not be seen through the letter. I don't believe it. That can only be seen as first one takes the whole chapter as a whole, get the touch of the whole, and see what is the main tone of the whole. Sometimes one can hardly express it in words. When one is discovering spiritual things, words are not adequate. With stammering lips, perhaps we may pronounce what we feel and touch. But little by little, as we culture that, it becomes more vivid and more definite until we can define it. But that's a process which is spiritual and not mental and not intellectual. And then usually the beauty comes out. Then usually one begins to see, oh yes, now here is a subject, over going over a page or two, and suddenly it changes the subject. And so one begins already to feel the difference between the first subject and the second subject, and one feels how she develops that second subject and develops it until suddenly one feels now she speaks of something very different again. And one gets again a feeling she changes the subject. And as we go on in that, and as this change of subject becomes spiritually clear, naturally a further question is coming up, namely, well, what is the ordered reasoning from subject to subject? Then one begins to ask, well, how does she lead thought from the first subject up to the last subject? And if we get at that point, that's really the main point. That's really then the order of the chapter. That's really the ordered spiritual unfoldment which we then find. And that to see that, not only to see that she changes the subject on page so-and-so, on line so-and-so, that doesn't do much. But to see how the first subject goes over to the second, and how the second needs the first in order to lead on the subject, and how it goes to the third, and to the fourth, and to the fifth, and how that step by step builds up the climax on the seventh subject. To see that, to grasp the spiritual meaning of that, that's the beauty of it. And that's living, and that's life. Why is it life? And I come to another point which we must keep in mind while studying, so that this study is not an intellectual hobby. What we are studying in the textbook is the birth of men. There exists nothing in the spiritual realm which is outside of these 16 chapters. See, the thought, the unillumined thought, reasons like this. The unillumined thought says, well, here I am, I have a life, I have a job, I have a life purpose, I have a life mission. And in order to put this life of mine straight and as harmonious as possible, I need a help, and that help may be the Bible, that help may be the textbook. And the thought still grows further, which feels that I am man, and there is next to that man a science, which is called the science of Christianity, which can help this man. We have still two things. We have still two things. We have still our present sense of manhood, or of life, or of living, and next to it, some scientific mean which we like to use. Well, that's not science. That's not what the textbook really presents. There is nothing outside the textbook which can be called man or life. The textbook is science of being, And being is a science of being, it's the whole being. It's our being. It's our structure. There is nothing outside of it. So there is not a life which we live and which we can make better by putting some of this science into our life. That would be a big duality. What we witness is that, and we'll see that so beautifully when we go through the chapters again, what we witness is that the textbook is the structure of man, and that the 16 chapters show the gradual revelation of that wonder which we can call scientific man. And there is no other man and no other structure of man but the 16 chapters. If we believe that man has two legs and two arms and that we can put some science of Christianity into that boogeyman, well, that's duality in the highest degree. Man is the idea of God, that which has not a single quality separate from God. That's man. And we only begin to find man as we begin to find the substance of the 16 chapters. So, if we open the textbook, then we don't open it because we will find there something which is outside of us, of man. But when we open that textbook, I always have the feeling, that's man. The spiritual meaning of this chapter is man, and I jolly well feel very humble and feel a sense of grace that I'm allowed to read through the symbols of English language what my true being is. But I find me, my structure, my being. And then one is so much nearer to one's own self. And then the nearer one is to one's own self, the clearer one's own self is revealed to us. So that's why I feel that even the approach to the book, the approach to the letter, is something which must be put right. And it's a prayerful approach. And that's why, right at the beginning of the textbook, is the chapter on prayer. Now, the chapter on prayer, before I start with that, but even that, ask us to consider being with a complete, unprejudiced mind. Now, that's something we have heard so often, but that's something which we see is lacking so often. That when we approach the textbook or the Bible, that we really approach it with an unpreconceived mind. And to have an unpreconceived mind is most necessary. And it's therefore most necessary to put away all preconceived concepts about God, about man, about the nature of God, about the nature of man, about the means of God, and about the purpose of God, about everything. Put everything always afresh away, what is in any way preconceived. And I'm quite sure that if we control ourselves every day, when we open the textbook and when we begin our search and our pondering on it, if we control ourselves and really ask ourselves, am I really unprejudiced? Did I say something wrong before? Did I say unprejudiced? Oh, that's right. Am I really unprejudiced in my attitude? Or do I want to find in the text something which I would like to find? That's also already prejudiced. If I approach a text and think, well, it would be jolly nice if in that text would be the 7, or would be the 4, or would be the diagonal, or would be this, or would be that. That's preconceived. That's not... That's prejudiced. See, but not unprejudiced. And that's already a human mind and a human picture, and with that human picture we can never see truth. The chapter on prayer has told us that only that which is of the nature of God can see God.